I'm Tom Hall. This is the Midday Health Watch. Dr. Lena Wen, the Health Commissioner of Baltimore City, joins me to talk about issues in public health. The political battle lines have been drawn in the race for governor. When it comes to health care, how do the actions of Governor Larry Hogan stack up against the proposals of Democratic challenger Ben Jealous? Earlier this month, the Trump administration proposed changes to Title X rules that some are calling a gag rule, restricting what physicians can tell their patients in conversations about reproductive health. The CARE Act, proposed by Elijah Cummings and Elizabeth Warren, takes a step forward. And if you're planning a picnic, tips for handling food in the great outdoors. Plus, theater critic J. Wynne Russick reviews Avenue Q at Cockpit in Court. Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Today, it's another edition of the Midday Health Watch. That's our chance to sit down with the Baltimore City Health Commissioner, Dr. Lena Wen, and talk about important public health issues and take your questions and comments. To join our conversation with Dr. Wen, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, to send us a tweet at @MiddayWIPR. And you can also follow us on the WIPR Facebook page where we are streaming this afternoon. Lena, it's good to see you.
Good to see you too, Tom. Thanks for having me back.
Always have so many things to talk to you about when you do come. Let's talk about these kids at the border, some of whom have ended up in Maryland. Evidently, Governor Hogan received a briefing from people at HHS who said that there are 10 children who have been separated from their families and who are being cared for here in Maryland. Do we know whether or not any of those kids are here in Baltimore? And is the health department involved in this at all?
We are not directly, although as a physician and public health official, I join so many other clinicians, psychologists, nurses, doctors who draw attention to the fact that we're causing people untold trauma. I mean, there are dozens of studies that have shown that separating children from their caregivers will result in such severe trauma that it damages irreversibly. It changes the brain architecture, that it even changes the child's DNA, making them more susceptible to infections, more likely to have mental illness, more likely to have addiction and suicide, and even physical issues like diabetes and heart disease. It's unconscionable to me that we are knowingly inflicting cruelty for really no reason. I mean, I was listening to Congressman Elijah Cummings, who was saying at a congressional committee hearing that we are better than this, that we have to be better than this. And I think back to my own experience. I came to this country just before my 8th birthday. My mother had come first, and my father and I followed. Neither of us spoke English. And I remember when we first arrived, and just feeling so overwhelmed and out of place. That, I mean, I was young, and you know, I cannot even imagine at that time if I were separated from my parents then. And I think about my own son. I think about my 10-month-old son and what that would be like for him to be all alone and what kind of damage that would do to us. And so, you know, we as a country have to do better because it's a moral issue, it's an ethical issue, but ultimately it's also a health issue. And we're impacting people's futures and damaging potentially their mental health and physical health.
Is there a particular reason, as far as you can tell, I wonder if you can speculate perhaps, why it is that the State Department of Human Services said that there are 3 facilities where these kids are being housed. There may be as many as 52 children who have arrived at the border themselves, you know, without their parents to begin with. But the State Department of Human Services doesn't want to identify where the children are being held. Is there a particular reason for that you can understand?
I don't know. This is not something that we've looked into or addressed with the state. Perhaps there might be privacy or safety concerns that might be cited. My concern is for the children and their well-being, and what kind of services they're getting there, and what are the plans for uniting them with their family members who are so desperately seeking them too. Again, I just can't imagine what I would be feeling as a mom, knowing that my child, I mean, when we were housing unaccompanied minors before, they tended to be older. Now these are babies, they're toddlers who can't advocate for themselves. And they're also children who don't speak English and certainly don't know our legal process. I mean, many of these children and families have escaped persecution like my family did. They've escaped violence and war and untold trauma back home. And we're inflicting more on them here.
Yeah, the trauma didn't start here, certainly. That's for sure. There's a scholar, and forgive me, I forget his name, who published a paper maybe 20 years ago in which he referred to babies like yours. We talk about Eli all the time on this show, your 10-month-old, as mother babies. They're not really babies because they don't really have the capacity to exist in the world without their mothers. I mean, they are not independent creatures. I talked to a guy who wrote a book about, of all things, popularity and what makes things hits and misses and stuff. And he had research that said, as a species, humans are the only ones who take about 8 years to be able to live independently. I mean, in the animal kingdom, that's not the case. I mean, you can leave the nest, you can leave the your parents much earlier. But human beings, you know, you got to be 8 or 9 years old before you have some semblance of knowing what to do. But even then, of course, it's traumatic, if you can imagine, you know, as you say, these kids arriving at the border not speaking English and not knowing anything other than the trauma they've experienced at home. The Trump administration has rescinded its order to separate them. But there are thousands of kids affected, and they're all over the country, and it looks like it's going to be a very slow process to find them. But is the health department, are you gearing up for any influx? I mean, is this on your radar screen in terms of public health here in Baltimore?
In terms of direct services, it's not something that we have been involved with before. Certainly, if we are called upon to do so, we will do. I mean, we are working with all of our nonprofit organizations to strengthen their access to trauma, mental health services, childcare services. But I think that it's my duty as a public health professional, my duty as a physician, to join hundreds of thousands of other doctors and clinicians to talk about why this is a public health crisis. If we found out that there was a disease or an outbreak of some kind that's causing irreversible damage to thousands of our children and their futures, we would be doing something about it. And we need to do something about this crisis, too.
We had an election this week. On Tuesday, the Democrats nominated Ben Jealous, former head of the NAACP, to be the standard bearer against Governor Larry Hogan. Let's think about some of the proposals that Mr. Jealous has made and some of the actions that Governor Hogan has taken. What's your take on a single-payer health plan? Is that a good idea? Is that a feasible idea? It's certainly one that Governor Hogan opposes, but Mr. Jealous ran on as part of his campaign.
Well, first of all, I want to preface my comments by saying that it's important in my role as an appointed public health official to be political but not partisan. And by that, I mean, I can't shy away from political issues. Talking about healthcare access, we talk about the Affordable Care Act, and by that phrase alone, it conjures up political consequences. So it's important to be political because the politics and policies directly impact the services that I'm able to provide to the residents in our city, some of whom are the most vulnerable. We provide these safety net services. But I'm not partisan. So I can have personal beliefs, but I would never say Republicans this or Democrats this or support one candidate over another or their proposals over another. So I'll preface that.
Sure.
I will say that on my end, what I see for our residents in Baltimore, what I see for the patients that I take care of is that we need a healthcare system that is affordable because people can't be priced out of the ability to live. We need it to be high quality because that's what we deserve in this country that has great wealth and actually does have access to some of the best resources. And we need universal access to care. I practiced medicine before the Affordable Care Act, and I saw how many patients waited for weeks or months or years and had cancers that could have been treated earlier, but now they're dying from them, had legs that were amputated because of diabetes, but actually they could have had it treated and prevented in the first place. I mean, that just should not be happening. I have personally been a proponent of single-payer healthcare since I was a medical student. From 2001 was when I started medical school, and I led the American Medical Student Association, which championed single-payer. I still think that it is...
And we should say, by the way, that Mr. Jealous refers to it as Medicare for all.
That's the
encomium he puts on it.
Similar idea, and the concept is that we want universal access to healthcare. I mean, that is ultimately what we all, I think we should all be advocating for, which is that health should be a fundamental human right. Now, with the Affordable Care Act, with Obamacare, that was one huge step in the right direction. And I strongly believe that we should do everything we can to strengthen the Affordable Care Act. However, if there is political will, if we have the ability as a state to really change how we're delivering healthcare, then we should do that because healthcare should be a fundamental right and we can no longer tolerate the status quo.
From your reading and your looking into this over the years, even before you became the health commissioner, does doing it as a state rather than a Medicare for All program that would be federal and would cover all 50 states, is it possible for the state of Maryland to have something resembling Medicare for All or a single payer system that's limited to Maryland?
This is a hard question to answer because so much depends on the federal landscape. Maryland has the all-payer system, which is unique, and our global budgeting has already changed a lot with changing medical care from being fee-for-service to really prioritizing the population health needs of our state. We need to expand on this. To switch to a single-payer system directly, to Medicare for All directly, would require federal approval, which I'm not sure we'll be able to obtain with this current administration. That said, there are many additional steps that can be taken with this frame in mind. For example, we can work on having affordable prescription drug coverage. 1 in 4 seniors report that they have trouble paying for their medications and are deciding every day between things like food and rent and their blood thinners. That shouldn't happen. There are proposals that I don't know how these gubernatorial candidates feel about this, but in other states, there have been proposals to reduce the cost of prescription drugs, including through reimportation from other countries. Certainly, it's something that I advocate for on a national level as well, for healthcare access reform on a national level and reducing prescription drug prices on a national level. Recently, I joined Public Citizen as an example to ask the Trump administration to issue a special order for getting the price of naloxone, the opioid antidote, at a reasonable rate that we can actually afford in the middle of this opioid epidemic.
Because we're still rationing naloxone here in the city, right?
Naloxone is available by the pennies in other countries. It costs us in Baltimore $75 for a kit of naloxone. At a time of an epidemic when there are people dying at unprecedented rates in Maryland and in Baltimore and across the country, it's something that the federal government can step up to do. But the state, which has been a good partner with us so far, can also do more. And I think especially at a time when we're facing such severe challenges on the federal level, we in Baltimore, you and I have talked about this before, we got a large cut to our teen pregnancy prevention grant. We are getting cuts all the time to our core safety net. There are threats to Medicaid, to other core safety net provisions that protect the health and well-being of our residents. I would look for the governor, the state legislature, to really step up and help Marylanders. And because ultimately health ties into everything else. And there are things that we can do right now to protect health in light of all these federal changes.
One of the things that Mr. Jealous and virtually everybody else who ran against him in the Democratic primary pointed to as a revenue source was legalizing recreational marijuana. What are the public health implications of legalized marijuana?
There are numerous studies that I believe are being conducted on the long-term consequences of recreational marijuana that are still ongoing. It's a difficult issue because on the one hand, we know that the consequences of criminalizing individuals for marijuana use it's resulted in mass incarceration. It's resulted in communities like ours in Baltimore being decimated. And of course, there are significant racial disparities in arrests and in consequences. On the other hand, the causes or the long-term effects of marijuana, especially on the developing brain, are yet unknown. And so this is an area that requires further study. And especially nowadays, there are competing interests. There are those, for example, who frequently write to my office and write to me and talk to me and want to talk to me about using marijuana to treat opioid use disorder. We definitely have an issue with addiction to opioids in across the country. But marijuana is not one of the three FDA-approved medications for the treatment of opioid use disorder. And so it is important for us to be clear about what it is that we're passing the policy for and making sure that at every step of the way, we're following science and the best available evidence.
Going to take a little bit of a break, and then when we come back, we'll have more of the Midday Health Watch with Dr. Lena Nguyen. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle at Midday WIPR. If you want to follow me on Twitter at Tom Hall WIPR, and we are streaming on the WIPR Facebook page. By the way, Dr. Nguyen and Mayor Catherine Pugh will participate in a line dancing class tonight at 6 o'clock. Are you a good dancer?
We'll find out.
We'll find
out. And Eli will be with me, too. So I'm
going to
demonstrate how one can dance with a baby strapped to them, a 20-pound baby strapped
to them. That's pretty good. You know, everybody else should have a backpack to make it even. But it is part of the Billion Step Challenge, right? They're encouraging all of us Baltimoreans to get moving. So far as a city, we've clocked more than 750 million steps, so you say. I'll take your word for it. Randy Dennis from Magic 95.9 Radio will be there. They thought of asking me, and then they saw me dance, and they said, nah, not such a good idea. It starts at 6 o'clock at the League for People with Disabilities in Northeast Baltimore. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
This is your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, a conversation with the former director of the CIA and the NSA, General Michael Hayden. His latest book sounds the alarm about the state of the intelligence community and the security of our country. It's called The Assault on Intelligence, American National Security in the Age of Lies. General Michael Hayden is my guest tomorrow on Midday. If you're just joining us today, it's the Midday Health Watch with Dr. Lena Nguyen. She's the health commissioner of the city of Baltimore. Our phone number, if you have a question or a comment for Dr. Nguyen, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. And we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. Let's talk a little bit about opioids from a number of different angles. Congressman Cummings and Senator Elizabeth Warren introduced a thing called the CARE Act, which is to sort of, you know, it's kind of the shock and awe approach to the opioid crisis, where they compared it to the AIDS crisis, saying we need a major, major federal legislative effort. They are picking up steam a little bit on this. They've got people like Nancy Pelosi, Steny Hoyer, Jim Clyburn from South Carolina signing on to the bill. As you understand it, what's going on with the CARE Act as it makes its way through the legislative process, and is this a good way of approaching the problem?
In the time that we are speaking on Midday, there'll be five people around the country who have died from overdose. Today in Baltimore, on an average day, there are two people who have died from overdose. I mean, there's no question that this is an epidemic, and it's escalating. The numbers keep on increasing. The number of people who have died from fentanyl, even as recently as 4 years ago in our city, was 12. Now that number is over 500. We need to do something that is dramatic. I mean, we need to devote the resources that are appropriate for the scope of the epidemic. And so I absolutely support what Congressman Cummings and Senator Warren have done in introducing the CARE Act, which is called the Ryan White for the opioid epidemic. 30 years ago or so, the HIV AIDS epidemic was at its peak. And some people were saying, well, no matter what we do, no matter how many resources we put in, we're not going to make a difference. But actually, Ryan White made a big difference because it was funding that's sustained, because you can't just do one-off, one-year-at-a-time funding for an epidemic. It was direct, which means that it goes directly to local jurisdictions that are in highest need based on a formula. And it was also at a degree that is proportional to the severity of the epidemic. If Ryan White worked for the HIV/AIDS epidemic, it can work for the opioid epidemic, and it's something that we quite desperately need. Last week, actually, Congress passed a whole slew of bills, this omnibus bill addressing opioids, and there were many things in it. But when I look at them, all of them are tinkering around the edges. Yes, they may help with strengthening regulations in some areas or helping us with medical records. I mean, there are some things that may be effective. However, they won't make a dent to the epidemic. We actually know what works. Yesterday, the state health commissioner in West Virginia, Dr. Rahul Gupta, and I wrote an op-ed in The Hill talking about what will work for both rural and urban jurisdictions. And the CARE Act is something that will be a huge help to us. And really, it's the only thing that will, because we need such a sustained infusion of resources directly to places like ours that are the hardest hit.
Congressman Cummings had some very pointed criticisms about the Trump administration's failure to really respond to the opioid crisis. We do have an Office of National Drug Control Policy, and Mr. Trump appointed a 24-year-old recent intern, a guy named Tyler Wayneth, to be its director. They eventually demoted him and put somebody else in charge there, but they have been slow to act, and it's a lot of money that they're talking about. It's in the billions. It's not, in the millions. Congress did pass, this is according to Congressman Cummings' office just this morning, something called the Crisis Act. It's a long acronym, but it has to do with fully funding and implementing the Office of National Drug Control Policy, and it's co-sponsored by Trey Gowdy, a Republican. So that did pass this morning, or did pass recently, and we've just heard about it this morning, I guess. So they are, they could be chiseling around the edges, but it sounds like there's some small movement there. In terms of the two gubernatorial candidates, incumbent Larry Hogan ran the last time some measure about addressing the opioid crisis. He certainly recognized it as a candidate 4 years ago. How do you think his response has been in office, and what do you think of Mr. Jealous's plans as you know them?
Again, I can't comment, would not wish to comment on specific candidates. What I will say is that the three things. First, the epidemic continues to worsen, even though we know what works. Second, we do need the assistance of the federal government. This is not something that the city or state alone can do. And the state has been helping us with getting funding for naloxone and helping us to fund the stabilization center. But third, there is a lot more that can be done. There's a lot more that can be done, for example, to promote, scale up the programs that we know are working here. Stabilization Center, crisis services are one element of that. Our lead program, Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion, where we are giving people treatment instead of incarceration, another program that really should be scaled up and can be scaled up easily. All of our work to expand treatment. Here in Baltimore City, we've done a lot. Recently, we launched Levels of Care with our hospitals with the idea that under Mayor Pugh's leadership that we cannot just be talking about addiction separately from any other illness. It should be treated the same way as we would any other medical illness and therefore treated in doctors' offices and in hospitals. There's a lot more that the state can do, and I hope that whoever is our next governor or remains our next governor will look at what we have done in Baltimore, look at the examples of what we've already done successfully, where we've already moved the needle. We've saved now over 2,100 lives with my standing order in the last 2.5 years. We can do so much more. Just give us the opportunity to scale it up here in Baltimore and across the state.
Let me ask a little bit more about levels of care, this thing that has to do with the hospitals. We've talked about it before. But what is the state's role legislatively when it comes to how hospitals are, giving out medical care? That's an interesting intersection there, isn't it?
That's right. From my vantage point in Baltimore City, I don't have regulatory authority over our hospitals. And so everything has been done voluntarily in collaboration with our hospitals. And I want to commend Mayor Pugh and our hospitals for being partners in this. I mean, to step up in this time of an epidemic and say, let's do everything we can is really important. And our hospitals have committed now. They've worked with us to develop these three levels, which we should be releasing shortly. And nearly all of our hospital emergency departments provide buprenorphine, so medication-assisted treatment on demand. That's something no other major city in the or any other city in the U.S. does. We now have peer recovery specialists in nearly all of our emergency departments. All of our hospitals have standardized discharge protocols for individuals leaving with opioid use issues and possibility for overdose. I mean, this is really incredible. And so the state can do, though.
And right now they're doing this all voluntarily.
That's exactly right. And I, again, commend our hospital leadership for working with us for the last 3.5 years to advance this. But there's a lot more that can be done with the regulatory authority of the state. And I hope that's something that I will work with the next governor and the state legislature to do, because at a time of crisis, we all have to step up. And this is something that we can ask for our hospital systems, federally qualified health centers, and all of our doctors and clinicians to do too.
We should say that Mr. Jealous has made it a centerpiece of his campaign as well, devoting an additional $2 million in state funding to get naloxone into the hands of folks who can help people, and several other proposals about opioids. So certainly it seems that both the candidates are at least taking it seriously, and that's a good sign. Back to the federal level, Title 10. This is a grant program. We've heard a lot about Title IX, for example, which people talk about in terms of women and sports in college and that kind of stuff. So there are these various different grant programs. Title 10 has to do with reproductive health. And the Trump administration earlier this month issued some new proposals for changing the guidelines for the dispersal of these funds. So can you tell us what they proposed and what you think the consequences would be?
There is so much coming out of the Trump administration on a daily basis that things like the Title 10 changes have gotten lost in the news. So I'm very glad that you're covering this, because it is one of the most devastating things that the Trump administration is proposing to do. So Title 10 is the federal family planning program. It was established nearly 50 years ago and specifically funds things like breast and cervical cancer screening, testing for sexually transmitted diseases, and very importantly, evidence-based, affordable birth control. Here in Baltimore City, my health department, we oversee Title 10 funding, which is distributed to 23 clinics in our area. And just to tell you how important this is, one in three women in Baltimore are in need of publicly funded healthcare services to access any form of contraception. Title 10 is
also...
One in three. Yeah. And Title 10 is a major reason for why we have a record low of unintended pregnancies, and we have a record low in teen birth rates, a drop of 61% here in Baltimore between 2000 and 2016. So what the Trump administration is proposing to do is two things. First, they are preventing any clinics that receive Title 10 funding from performing abortions. And so specifically, we need to note that Title 10 does not actually fund abortion services at all. But they're saying that they will deny Title 10 funding to clinics that provide abortions or are even affiliated with other clinics that provide abortions.
So right now, if you're getting Title 10 funding, you sequester that. You keep it separate from any of the revenue that is allocated towards that part of your medical treatment that involves abortion, right? Right now, the recipients are keeping a firewall between those two parts of the service.
Absolutely. It would be illegal to use Title 10 funding for anything except its intended use, which is contraceptive care, STD screening, cancer screenings, et cetera. And so what will happen if they impose this and cut off funding is that many safety net clinics will have to shut down. And many studies, including from Kaiser Health Institute and others, have found that the existing other safety net clinics are not going to be nearly sufficient. But, you know, that's one thing, and that's been reported, and I'm very concerned about access to healthcare. But there's a second thing that these Title 10 regulations propose to do. They will institute, for the first time, a gag rule so that clinicians can no longer refer pregnant women to legal, evidence-based reproductive health choices. And in fact, that doctors, nurses, social workers will have a heavily censored script for what they can and cannot say to patients. So even if a patient comes in saying that they're requesting an abortion or that they're looking for certain types of reproductive services, the clinician, if these rule changes go through, will have to tell them that they can't speak any further about this. I mean, it's totally incomprehensible to me that the federal government is legislating, is telling physicians, nurses, social workers what we can and cannot say, that now we have to give incomplete, unreliable, and just unscientific information about scientific and medical treatments. So the implications, I think, are really staggering. I mean, it's undermining patient rights, but it also goes against the core values of every profession. And that's why the American Medical Association, the American Nurses Association, and so many others have come out saying this is a fundamental violation of who we are and why we're in these healing professions.
The Trump administration is saying that you as a physician can still counsel on abortion, but they can't give referrals. But what you're saying is that the Trump administration is requiring literally taking an arrow out of the quiver. You're just simply, this is not one of the things that you would be able to talk. You'd be able to talk about anything else other than saying, if you choose to have an abortion, and here may be the reasons you might want to choose, here's the upside, here's the downside. They can't refer the patient to a particular place that can provide a safe and, for now, legal abortion.
You know, here's my issue with all of this. I don't think that the government has any role in getting between a doctor and a patient or a nurse and a patient and saying, here's what you can and cannot say to your patient. This is about evidence-based standard medical care. And I would not support any regulations by the federal government saying, here's what you're allowed to tell your patient, even though it's legal, even though it is science-based and evidence-based. And by the way, this Title X change also alters the definition of evidence-based family planning. It actually de-emphasizes contraceptive care, such including barrier methods like condoms and other things like IUDs. But instead, it promotes non-FDA-approved methods like fertility awareness and promotes abstinence and adoption. Those are all options that may need to be discussed if the woman brings it up, if the doctor brings it up, but to legislate, not based on evidence, but based on ideology, is something that just goes against every aspect of my being as a woman, as a doctor, and as a scientist.
This isn't the first time the federal government has imposed a gag rule. In 1988, the Reagan administration had it in place, where at that point you weren't even allowed to mention abortion. It just simply couldn't pass the lips of a physician. That was rescinded in subsequent administrations, and now the Trump administration is doing something much more similar to the 1988 Reagan gag rule than it is to, the regulations that were in place during the Clinton or Obama administration, certainly. Justice Anthony Kennedy announced yesterday that he's resigning or retiring from the Supreme Court. So Mr. Trump will have a pick. Whether or not it happens before the November midterms is anybody's guess right now. But he ran on a platform of appointing judges who would overturn the famous Roe versus Wade decision from the 1970s. Were that to happen, and this, again, there's a lot of stuff that has to happen between now and that point, but if Roe is overturned at the Supreme Court, it will affect different states differently. There are some estimates that there could be as many as 30 or so states who would immediately prohibit legal abortion. What would the impact here in Maryland be were Roe v. Wade to be overturned by some future court?
You know, when I went to medical school in Missouri, which has very different politics and ideology than we do here, and I remember as a medical student treating women who attempted abortions on their own or pregnancy terminations on their own. And one woman was so ill that she had a total body infection. She needed to go to the operating room immediately and then was in the ICU for weeks. She barely survived. This is what we could go back to as a country if we forbid a legal, evidence-based scientific procedure. I mean, I saw a Gallup poll a couple weeks ago asking Americans what they think about abortion. And all I could think about is, when do we ask Americans or anyone what they think about any other medical procedure? We don't have a poll asking people, what do you think about appendectomies or gallbladder surgeries? Why are we asking for people's opinions when this is about standard evidence-based medical care? We in Maryland, thankfully, have legislators, have had governors who strongly defend women's rights. And I hope that whoever is our next governor or may our next governor will continue to strongly defend women's rights. You know, it's about opportunity for women. It's about the sanctity of the doctor-patient relationship. It's also about care for our most vulnerable, because we're going to have a situation, if Roe v. Wade is overturned, where rich people will have access to whatever services they need. But those who are poor, those who are low income, those with limited means, they are the ones who will suffer the most. And we already have such vast disparities and lack of access in our country. I hope that whoever is our next governor will continue to reaffirm these rights that are so important.
Let's see if we can grab one quick phone call before we have to let you go. Frank in Aberdeen, welcome to Midday with Dr. Nguyen.
Good afternoon.
Hi, what's on your mind?
The proposal of Trump putting a gag order on doctors is the exact flip side of the California case where the state was forcing these clinics to divulge information it did not want to divulge. And the gag order is actually worse.
All right. Well, thanks for that comment, Frank. I'm not familiar with the California case. Dr. Nguyen, are you?
I am, because we are involved in a similar lawsuit here in Baltimore City. My understanding of this, and I'm no lawyer, so not speaking in legalese here, but my understanding is that clinics that do not provide the full range of reproductive health services currently promote themselves as such. And yet, when you go in and women go in, they find out that they're not going to be counseled on all their options. They're only going to be offered one specific set of options and not the other ones. So the legislation in California, in Baltimore, were that these clinics would be required to post a sign saying that here are the services that they're able to offer and here are the services that they can't. And these clinics are now suing based on First Amendment grounds. And the Supreme Court case, I believe, upheld these clinics' views. For us, this is a matter of evidence and science. For us, it's a matter of giving patients access to information that is accurate. And so from our standpoint, we strongly believe in continuing to value that, to value women's decisions and the relationship that they have with their doctor without government interference.
Tracy sends us an email, says, since when is it legal in a democracy to dictate what a health professional may say to a patient? This is exactly the point you've been making, Dr. Nguyen. We have Bobby in Baltimore who emails us about opioid addiction, saying even in 2018, there's such a stigma associated with addiction that bleeds into the way we talk about it and deal with it. It's one of those uncomfortable things that politicians often simply avoid truly addressing. The only way to move the needle on this is to talk honestly and openly about it, the bad and the ugly and the painful parts included. I think you'd probably agree with that emailer.
Absolutely. And we need to emphasize for the disease of addiction that it is a disease. There is treatment that's evidence-based, science-based, that is available, and recovery is possible. And for addiction and for reproductive health, we should think about these as these are all standard medical treatments for things that we have evidence for. And we need to think about reproductive health in the same way, because health is a fundamental human right.
Dr. Nguyen, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much, and we'll see you the next time.
Thank you.
Dr. Lena Nguyen is the health commissioner for Baltimore City. She joins us every few weeks here in Studio A for the Midday Health Watch. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, theater critic J. Wynn Russick will tell us about Cockpit in Court's new production of Avenue Q. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.